Chapter 7. During her dreary stay at Ardis, a considerably changed and enlarged Kim Bo-ha-nae called upon her. He carried under his arm an album bound in orange-brown cloth, a dirty hue she had hated all her life. In the last 2 or 3 years, she had not seen him. The light-footed, lean lad with the sallow complexion had become a dusky colossus, vaguely resembling a Janissary in some exotic opera, stomping in to announce an invasion or an execution. Uncle Dan, who just then was being wheeled out by his handsome and haughty nurse into the garden where coppery and blood-red leaves were falling, clamored to be given the big book. But Kim said, "Perhaps later," and joined Ada in the reception corner of the hall. He had brought her a present, a collection of photographs he had taken in the good old days. He had been hoping the good old days would resume their course, but since he understood that Monsieur votre cousin, he spoke a thick Creole, thinking that its use in solemn circumstances would be more proper than his everyday Lador English, was not expected to revisit the castle soon, and thus help bring the album up to date. The best procedure pour tous les cernés, the shadowed ones, the encircled rather than concerned, might be for her to keep, or destroy and forget so as not to hurt anybody, the illustrated document now in her pretty hands. Wincing angrily at the jolie, Ada opened the album at one of its maroon markers meaningly inserted here and there, glanced once, reclicked the clasp, handed the grinning blackmailer a $1,000 note that she happened to have in her bag, summoned Boutillon, and told him to throw Kim out. The mud-colored scrapbook remained on a chair under her Spanish shawl. With a shuffling kick, the old retainer expelled a swamp tulip leaf swept in by the draft and closed the front door again.
"Mademoiselle n'aurait jamais dû recevoir ce gradin," he grumbled on his way back through the hall.
"That's just what I was on the point of observing," said Vaughn, when Ada had finished relating the nasty incident. "Were the photos pretty filthy?"
"Ah,"
exhaled Ada. "That money might have furthered a worthier cause. Home for blind colts or aging ashettes."
"Odd you're saying that."
"Why?"
"Never mind. Anyway, the beastly thing is now safe. I had to pay for it, lest he show poor Marina pictures of Van seducing his little cousin Ada, which would have been bad enough. Actually, as a hawk of genius, he may have suspected the whole truth."
"So you really think that because you bought his album for a paltry $1,000, all evidence has been disposed of and everything is in order?"
"Why, yes. Do you think the sum was too mean? I might send him more. I know where to reach him. He lectures, if you please, on the art of shooting life at the School of Photography in Calugano."
"Good place for shooting," said Vaughn. "So you are quite sure you own the beastly thing?"
"Of course I do. It's with me at the bottom of that trunk. I'll show it to you in a moment."
"Tell me, my love, what was your so-called IQ when we first met?"
200 and something. A sensational figure."
"Well, by now it has shrunk rather badly. Peking Kim has kept all the negatives plus lots of pictures he will paste or post later."
"Would you say it has dropped to Cordula's level?"
"Lower. Now let's look at those snapshots before settling his monthly salary." The first item in the Evil series had projected one of Van's initial impressions of Ardis Manor at an angle that differed from that of his own recollection. Its area lay between the shadow of a caleche darkening the gravel and the white step of a pillared porch shining in the sun. Marina, one arm still in the sleeve of the dust coat, which a footman, Price, was helping her to remove, stood brandishing her free arm in a theatrical gesture of welcome, entirely at variance with the grimace of helpless beatitude twisting her face, while Ada, in a black hockey blazer, belonging really to Vanda, spilled her hair over her bare knees as she flexed them and flipped Dak with her flowers to check his nervous barks. Then came several preparatory views of the immediate grounds. The Colludia Circle, an avenue,
the grotto's black O, and the hill, and the big chain around the trunk of the rare oak, Quercus Ruslan, Chet, and a number of other spots meant to be picturesque by the compiler of the illustrated pamphlet, but looking a little shabby, owing to inexperienced photography. It improved gradually. Another girl, Blanche, stooping and squatting exactly like Ada, and indeed not unlike her in features, over Van's valise opened on the floor and, eating with her eyes, the silhouette of Ivory Reverie in a perfume advertisement. Then the cross and the shade of boughs above the grave of Marina's dear housekeeper, Anna Pimenovna Nepraslinov, 1797-1883. Let's skip nature shots of skunk-like squirrels, of a striped fish in a bubble tank, of a canary in its pretty prison. A photograph of an oval painting, considerably diminished, portrayed Princess Sofia Zemsky, as she was at 20 in 1775, with her two children, Marina's grandfather born in 1772 and Demand's grandmother born in 1773. "I don't seem to remember it," said Vaughn. "Where did it hang?" "In Marina's boudoir. And do you know who this bum in the frock coat is?"
"Looks to me like a poor print cut out of a magazine. Who's he?"
"Sumarechnikov. He took sumarographs of Uncle Vanya years ago."
"The twilight before the Lumiere. Hey, and here's Alonzo, the swimming pool expert. I met his sweet, sad daughter at a Cyprian party. She felt and smelt and melted like you. The strong charm of coincidence."
"I'm not interested. Now comes a little boy."
"Zdrastya, Ivan Dementyevich," said Van, greeting his 14-year-old self, shirtless, in shorts, aiming a conical missile at the marble foreimage of a Crimean girl doomed to offer an everlasting draft of marble water to a dying marine from her bullet-chipped jar. Skip Lucette, skipping rope.
"Ah, the famous first finch. No, that's a Kataskaya punichka, Chinese wall bunting. It is settled on the threshold of a basement door. The door is ajar. There are garden tools and croquet mallets inside. You remember how many exotic, alpine, and polar animals mixed with ordinary ones in our region?"
Lunchtime. Ada bending low over the dripping peach improperly peeled that she is devouring, shot from the garden through the French window. Drama and comedy. Blanche struggling with two amorous tsigan in the Bagnodier bower. Uncle Dan calmly reading a newspaper in his little red motor car, hopelessly stuck in black mud on the Lador Road. Two huge common peacock moths, still connected. Grooms and gardeners brought Ada that species every blessed year. "Which, in a way, reminds us of you, sweet Marco d'Andrea, or you, red-haired Domenico Benci, or you, dark and broody Giovanni del Brina, who thought they were bats, or the one I dare not mention because it is Lucette's scholarly contribution, so easily botched after the scholar's death, who likewise might have picked up at the foot of an orchid wall, not overhung with not yet imported wisteria, her half-sister's edition, on a May morning in 1542 near Florence, a pair of the pear peacock in copula, the male with the feathery antennae, the female with the plain threads, to depict them faithfully, among wretched, unvisualized insects, on one side of a fenestral niche in the so-called elements room of the Palazzo Vecchio. Sunrise at Ardis. Kongs. Naked Vaughn still cocooned in his hammock under the Lyderons, as they called in Lador the Lyriodendrons. Not exactly a lit d'Edredon, though worth an auroral pun and certainly conducive to the physical expression of a young dreamer's fancy undisguised by the network. "Congratulations," repeated Vaughn in male language, "the first indecent postcard. Bugh Horney, no doubt, has a blow-up copy in his private stock." Ada examined the pattern of the hammock through a magnifying glass, used by Vaughn for deciphering certain details of his lunatic's drawings.
"I'm afraid there's more to come," she remarked with a catch in her voice, and taking advantage of their looking at the album in bed, which we now think lacked taste, Odd Ada used the reading loop on Live Vaughn, something she had done many times as a scientifically curious and artistically depraved child in that year of grace here depicted. "I'll find a moosh patch to conceal it," she said, returning to the leering caruncula in the unreticent reticulation. "By the way, you have quite a collection of black masks in your dresser."
"For masked balls, bal masqué," murmured Vaughn.
A comparison piece. Ada's very much exposed white thighs. Her birthday skirt had got entangled with twigs and leaves, straddling a black limb of the Tree of Eden. Thereafter, several shots of the 1884 picnic, such as Ada and Grace dancing a Lyaskan fling, and reversed Vaughn nibbling at pine star warts. Conjectural identification.
"That's finished," said Vaughn.
"A precious sinistral sinew has stopped functioning. I can still fence and deliver a fine punch, but hand-walking is out."
"You shall not sniffle, Ada."
"Ada is not going to sniffle and wail. King Wing says that the great Vecchello turned back into an ordinary Chelovec at the age I'm now, so everything is perfectly normal. Ah, drunken Ben Wright trying to rape Blanche in the mews. She has quite a big part in this farrago."
"He's doing nothing of the sort. You see quite well they are dancing. It's like the beast and the bell at the ball where Cinderella loses her garter and the prince his beautiful codpiece of glass. You can also make out Mr. Ward and Mrs. French in a Bruegelish kimbo, peasant prance, at the farther end of the hall. All those rural rapes in our parts have been grossly exaggerated. D'ailleurs, it was Mr. Ben Wright's last pitar at Ardis."
Ada, on the balcony, photographed by our acrobatic voyeur from the roof edge, drawing one of her favorite flowers, a Lador Cytirion, silky-haired, fleshy, erect. Vaughn thought he recalled that particular sunny evening, the excitement, the softness, and some casual words he had muttered in connection with an inane botanical comment of his, "My flower opens only at dusk," the one she was moistly moving. A formal photograph on a separate page, a Dotchka, pretty and impure in her flimsy, and Venechka in gray flannel suit with slant-striped school tie facing the chimera, side by side, at attention, he with the shadow of a forced grin, she expressionless. Both recalled the time between the first tiny cross and a whole graveyard of kisses, and the occasion. It was ordered by Marina, who had it framed and set up in her bedroom next to a picture of her brother at 12 or 14, clad in a baronka, open shirt, and cupping a guinea pig in his galpin, hollowed hands. The three looked like siblings, with the dead boy providing a vivisectional alibi. Another photograph was taken in the same circumstances, but for some reason had been rejected by capricious Marina. At a tripod table, Ada sat reading, her half-clenched hand covering the lower part of the page. A very rare, radiant, seemingly uncalled-for smile shone on her practically Moorish lips. Her hair flowed partly across her collarbone and partly down her back. Vaughn stood inclining his head above her and looked, unseeing, at the opened book. In full, deliberate consciousness, at the moment of the hooded click, he bunched the recent past with the imminent future and thought to himself that this would remain an objective perception of the real present, and that he must remember the flavor, the flash, the flesh of the present, as he indeed remembered it half a dozen years later, and now, in the second half of the next century. But what about the rare radiance on those adored lips? Bright derision can easily grade, through a cline of glee, into a look of rapture.
"Do you know, Vaughn, what book lay there, next to Marina's hand mirror and a pair of tweezers? I'll tell you. One of the most tawdry and Réjouissant novels that ever made the front page of the Manhattan Times Book Review. I'm sure your Cordula still had it in her cozy corner while you sat temple to temple after you jilted me.
Cat, said Vaughn.
Oh, much worse. Old Bechstein's Tabby was a masterpiece in comparison to this. This Love Under the Lindens by one Eelman, transposed into English by Thomas Gladstone, who seems to belong to a firm of packers and porters, because on the page which Adotchka, Adava Dotchka, Hell's daughter, happens to be relishing here, automobile is rendered as wagon. And to think that little Lucette had to study Eelman and three terrible toms in her literature course at Los. You remember that trash, but I remember our non-stop three-hour kiss under the larches immediately afterwards.
See next illustration, said Otta grimly.
The scoundrel, cried Vaughn. He must have been creeping after us on his belly with his entire apparatus. I will have to destroy him.
No more destruction, Vaughn. Only love.
But look, girl, here I'm glutting your tongue, and there I'm glued to your epiglottis, and—
Intermission, begged Ada.
Quick, quick. I'm ready to oblige till I'm 90, said Vaughn.
The vulgarity of the peep show was catchy.
90 times a month, roughly.
Make it even more, roughly, or much more, say 150. That would mean...
But in the sudden storm, calculations went to the canicular devils.
Well, said Vaughn, when the mind took over again, let's go back to our defaced childhood. I'm anxious, picking up the album from the bedside rug, to get rid of this burden.
Ah, a new character. The inscription says Dr. Krolik. Wait a sec. It may be the best vanishing Vaughn, but it's terribly messy all the same. Okay, yes, that's my poor nature teacher.
Knickerbockered, Panama-hatted, lusting for his babochka, Russian for lepidopteran. A passion, a sickness. What could Diana know about that chase?
How curious. In the state Kim mounted him here, he looks much less furry and fat than I imagined.
In fact, darling, he's a big, strong, handsome old March hare.
Explain.
There's nothing to explain. I asked Kim one day to help me carry some boxes there and back, and here's the visual proof. Besides, that's not my Krolik, but his brother, Carol or Karapar's Krolik, a doctor of philosophy, born in Turkey.
I love the way your eyes narrow when you tell a lie. The remote mirage in effrontery minor.
I'm not lying.
With lovely dignity,
he is a doctor of philosophy.
Vaughn ist auch Vaughn, murmured Vaughn, sounding the last word as Vaughn.
Our fondest dream, she continued, Krolik's and my fondest dream, was to describe and depict the early stages, from ova to pupa, of all the known fritillaries, greater and lesser, beginning with those of the New World. I would have been responsible for building an argininarium, a pest-proof breeding house with temperature patterns and other refinements, such as background night smells and night animal calls, to create a natural atmosphere in certain difficult cases. A caterpillar needs exquisite care. There are hundreds of species and good subspecies in both hemispheres, but I repeat, we'd begin with America. Live egg-laying females and live food plants, such as violets of numerous kinds, airmailed from everywhere, starting, for the heck of it, with Arctic habitats. Lyaska, Labrador, Victor Island. The magnanary would also be a violarium, full of fascinating flourishing plants from the endocanensis race of the northern marsh violet to the minute but magnificent Viola krolikii, recently described by Professor Hall from Goodson Bay. I would contribute colored figures of all the instars and line drawings of the perfect insect's genitalia and other structures. It would be a wonderful work.
A work of love, said Vaughn and turned the page.
Unfortunately, my dear collaborator died intestate,
and all his collections, including my own little part, were surrendered by a regular warren of collateral Kroliks to agents in Germany and dealers in Tartary. Disgraceful, unjust, and so sad. We'll find you another director of science. Now, what do we have here? Three footmen, Price, Norris, and Ward, dressed up as grotesque firemen. Young Boot, devotedly kissing the veined instep of a pretty bare foot raised and placed on a balustrade. Nocturnal outdoor shot of two small white ghosts pressing their noses from the inside to the library window. Artistically, Evantayed, all on one page, were seven fotochki, diminutive stills, taken within as many minutes, from a fairly distant lurk, in a setting of tall grass, wildflowers, and overhanging foliage. Its shade and the folly of peduncles delicately camouflaged the basic details, suggesting little more than a tussle between two incompletely clad children. In the central miniature, Ada's only limb in sight was her thin arm holding aloft in a static snatch, like a banner, her discarded dress above the daisy-starred grass. The magnifier, now retrieved from under the bedsheet, clearly showed topping the daisies in an upper picture, the type of tight-capped toadstool called in Scott's law, ever since witching was banned, the Lord of Erection. Another interesting plant, Marvel's melon, imitating the backside of an occupied lad, could be made out on the floral horizon of a third photo. In the next three stills, La Force des Choses, the fever of intercourse, had sufficiently disturbed the lush herbage to allow one to distinguish the details of a tangled composition consisting of clumsy Romany clips and illegal Nelsons. Finally, in the last picture, the lower one in the fan-like sequence, Ada was represented by her two hands rearranging her hair while her Adam stood over her, a frond or inflorescence veiling his thigh with the deliberate casualness of an old master's device to keep Eden chaste. In an equally casual tone of voice, Vaughn said, "Darling, you smoke too much. My belly is covered with your ashes. I suppose Bouteillin knows Professor Beauharnais's exact address in the Athens of graphic arts?" "You shall not slaughter him," said Ada. "He is subnormal. He is, perhaps, blackmailerish, but in his sordidity there is an istoshniston, visceral moan of crippled art. Furthermore, this page is the only really naughty one. And let's not forget that a copperhead of eight was also ambushed in the brush. Art, my foot, this is the hearse of ours, a toilet roll of the Carte du Tendre. I'm sorry you showed it to me. That ape has vulgarized our own mind pictures. I will either horsewhip his eyes out or redeem our childhood by making a book of it. Ardis, a family chronicle." "Oh, do," said Ada, skipping another abominable glimpse, apparently through a hole in the boards of the attic. "Look, here's our little Caliph Island." "I don't want to look anymore. I suspect you find that filth titillating. Some nuts get a kick from motor bikini comics."
"Please, Vaughn, do glance. These are our willows, remember?"
The castle bathed by the Adur. The guidebooks recommended that tour.
"It happens to be the only one in color. The willows look sort of greenish because the twigs are greenish, but actually they are leafless here. It's early spring, and you can see our red boat Souvenance through the rushes. And here's the last one, Kim's Apotheosis of Ardis."
The entire staff stood in several rows on the steps of the pillared porch behind the bank president, Baroness Veen, and the vice president, Ida La Riviere. Those two were flanked by the two prettiest typists, Blanche de la Tourberry, ethereal, tear-stained, entirely adorable, and a black girl who had been hired a few days before Vaughn's departure to help French, who towered rather sullenly above her in the second row, the focal point of which was Bouteillin, still wearing the costume sport he had on when driving off with Vaughn. That picture had been muffed or omitted. On the butler's right side stood three footmen. On his left, Boot, who had valeted Vaughn, the fat, flower-pale cook,
Blanche's father, and next to French, a terribly tweedy gentleman with sightseeing strappings athwart one shoulder, actually, according to Ada, a tourist, who, having come all the way from England to see Bryant's castle, had bicycled up the wrong road, and was in the picture, under the impression of accidentally being conjoined to a group of fellow tourists who were visiting some other old manor quite worth inspecting, too. The back rows consisted of less distinguished menservants and scullions, as well as of gardeners, stable boys, coachmen, shadows of columns, maids of maids, aides, laundresses, dresses, recesses, getting less and less distinct. As in those bank ads where limited little employees, dimly dimidated by more fortunate shoulders, but still asserting themselves, still smile in the process of humble dissolve.
"Isn't that Wheezy Jones in the second row? I always liked the old fellow."
"No," answered Ada. "That's Price. Jones came 4 years later. He is now a prominent policeman in Lower Lodore."
"Well, that's all."
Nonchalantly, Vaughn went back to the willows and said, "Every shot in the book has been snapped in 1884, except this one. I never rode you down Lodore River in early spring. Nice to note you have not lost your wonderful ability to blush."
"It's his error. He must have thrown in a fototchka taken later, maybe in 1888. We can rip it out if you like."
"Sweetheart," said Vaughn, "the whole of 1888 has been ripped out. One need not be a sleuth in a mystery story to see that at least as many pages have been removed as retained. I don't mind. I mean, I have no desire to see the Knabenkrauter and other pedants of your friends botanizing with you, but 1888 has been withheld, and he'll turn up with it when the first grand is spent."
"I destroyed 1888 myself," admitted proud Ada. "But I swear, I solemnly swear that the man behind Blanche in the Perron picture was and has always remained a complete stranger."
"Good for him," said Vaughn. "Really, it has no importance. It's our entire past that has been spoofed and condemned. On second thoughts, I will not write that family chronicle. By the way, where is my poor little Blanche now?"
"Oh, she's all right. She's still around. You know, she came back
after you abducted her. She married our Russian coachman, the one who replaced Bengal Ben, as the servants called him."
"Oh, she did.
That's delicious. Madame Trofim Fartikoff. I would never have thought it."
"They have a blind child," said Ada.
"Love is blind," said Vaughn.
"She tells me you made a pass at her on the first morning of your first arrival."
"Not documented by Kim," said Vaughn.
"Will their child remain blind? I mean, did you get them a really first-rate physician?"
"Oh, yes, hopelessly blind. But speaking of love and its myths, do you realize, because I never did before talking to her a couple of years ago, that the people around our affair had very good eyes indeed? Forget Kim. He's only the necessary clown. But do you realize what a veritable legend was growing around you and me while we played and made love?"
She had never realized, she said again and again, as if intent to reclaim the past from the matter-of-fact triviality of the album, that their first summer in the orchards and orchidariums of artists had become a sacred secret and creed throughout the countryside. Romantically inclined handmaids, whose reading consisted of Gwen de Vere and Clara Mertvago, adored Vaughn, adored Ada, adored artists' ardors in arbors. Their swains, plucking ballads on their seven-stringed Russian lyres under the Rasmusa in bloom or in old rose gardens, while the windows went out one by one in the castle, added freshly composed lines, naive, lackadaisical, but heartfelt, to cyclic folk songs. Eccentric police officers grew enamored with the glamour of incest. Gardeners paraphrased iridescent Persian poems about irrigation and the four arrows of love. Night watchmen fought insomnia and the fire of the clap
with the weapons of Vaniata's adventures. Herdsmen, spared by thunderbolts on remote hillsides, used their huge moaning horns as ear trumpets to catch the lilts of Lador. Virgin chatelaines in marble-floored manors fondled their lone flames fanned by Van's romance. And another century would pass, and the painted word would be retouched by the still richer brush of time. "All of which," said Van, "only means that our situation is desperate."